Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Scourge of War, The Life of William Tecumseh Sherman, by Brian Holden Reed, narrated by Paul Heitch. Introduction. William T. Sherman has not lacked admirers. He was one of the architects of the Northern victory in the American Civil War in 1865. Yet his popular image is unenviable. What has come down to us over the more than 150 years since the end of the Civil War is a depiction of a ruthless, utterly heartless, and unprincipled destroyer. Sherman was a stern, insistent, and brutal man, so the story runs, certainly not a gentleman. He appeared happy to unleash on the South unprecedented devastation by fire and sword. During his marches across Georgia and the Carolinas in 1864-65, the Confederate press likened his armies to the pillaging hordes of barbarians that despoiled the Western Roman Empire during its death throes. For hundreds of miles, not a house stood, not a living creature survived. This black portrait had the advantage for the defeated of placing the burden of guilt solely on the North, and one general in particular. Catastrophic Southern decisions were left out of the reckoning. Lurid descriptions of a return to barbarism encouraged later generations to link Sherman's advance into the Southern hinterland with the strategic air offensive launched by British and American bombers against Germany in 1943-45. Sherman's campaigns appeared prophetic, but he seemed a prophet of doom. The ever-expanding cycles of death and destruction unleashed by what came to be known as total war appeared insatiable. During the nuclear age, humankind appeared to stand on the brink of annihilation. When the origins of these cycles were investigated, it all appeared to begin with Sherman, and the Southern view of his wickedness appeared vindicated. Sherman's utter lack of moral sense, absence of restraint, and wild declarations appeared to have heralded all of these appalling developments. It was frequently claimed that Sherman should have been indicted for war crimes, like the Nazis put on trial at Nuremberg. This harshly etched depiction of Sherman retains, to this day, many adherents. There is only one difficulty with it. This diabolical image veers drastically from the reality of the historical Sherman. It reads historical change and Sherman's career back to front. It distorts their outlines to a point where they become unrecognizable. Instead, Sherman's military career should be assessed within the context of his own time. The dilemmas confronting Sherman and his peers resulted from the failure of the North to gain a quick victory during the opening campaign that culminated with the Union defeat at the First Battle of Bull Run in July 1861, in which he took part. During 1862, Northern armies occupied much Southern territory, but a decisive victory seemed as far distant as ever. In the autumn campaign of 1862, an outright Union defeat, though averted, seemed possible. Sherman discerned that Southern resistance was ferocious. Although he underestimated the strategic strength of the Northern position, he was correct in divining that the solution to winning lay in breaking Southern resistance. And that could only be done if the North showed superior resilience and will. Sherman sometimes doubted whether the North had the capacity to reveal these moral qualities and rise to the challenge. But he remained adamant that a display of Union military power was vital to exposing Southern weakness. The task that Sherman set himself was to sap Southern resistance and break the Confederacy's will to fight on. Precedents for such measures already existed in the Napoleonic Wars. While Sherman reflected on these problems, he came to understand that the solution lay in the very nature of war, the scourge of war. War was not a game, and should not be entered into lightly, as it was inherently violent and destructive. Sherman became seized by the idea, as he wrote, that war could be made so terrible that not only could the South be defeated and the war resources available to it seized or destroyed, but it could serve as a deterrent to prevent it recurring. These calculations were perfectly rational. It is an error to suppose that they represent mere mindless violence. It is also important to understand that Sherman meant that war should be made terrible psychologically. Southern pride should not just be broken. It had to be humiliated, and its boasts of martial superiority rendered false. Here, Sherman's experience of living in Louisiana in 1858-61 illuminated his path. Sherman was always more concerned with the psychological impact of his more vigorous measures and long advances, not just piling up the ashes of savage destruction. In any case, the levels of destruction attributed to him were simply beyond the capacity of the two small armies that he fielded during his marches. His method, then, was to grasp war's true nature rather than play at it to achieve victory and not to hesitate in taking the war to the enemy. So throughout 1863-65, Sherman expressed trenchant views on the North's need to exert itself, to organize and direct its power. He wanted it to act as a scourge on its enemies and bring about a complete Southern collapse. In the last year of the war, Sherman did successfully attack the Southern war economy, but more by psychological than physical means. His advances in Georgia and the Carolinas appeared unstoppable. He outthought, as well as outmaneuvered, his Confederate opponents, and his speed helped spread fear. He did not despise his foes. His plans were well thought out because he respected his opponents too much. Moreover, he acted on grounds of military necessity. This concept is consistent with the laws of war and perfectly legal. The laws are not designed to prevent defeat, even if the vanquished form the weaker side. Such Southern special pleading needs to be set aside. The South's sufferings were not unique or unprecedented. By comparison with the horrors of the Napoleonic Wars, they were comparatively mild. Viewed in the longer stream of Western military history, Sherman was not prophetic and did not anticipate the methods used during the two world wars of the 20th century. He simply recognized, with great clarity, that warfare is cruel and pitiless, a veritable scourge, and does not provide ready-made protection for the weaker side. Here, then, is a major arresting figure that played a significant role in the greatest drama in American history, the Civil War. But in Sherman's case, because he displayed obvious cerebral qualities, it is necessary to consider not just what he did, but also what he thought and wrote. Historians have often considered the relationship between military thought and execution, the difference between theory and practice, as puzzling, even intractable or enigmatic. What is the precise link between the intellect and the conduct of a great war? Is there one? In reappraising Sherman's military conduct and the thinking that lay behind it, the main aim of this book is to show how these two sides of one of the most admired but also most condemned of American commanders, the thinker and the doer, intermesh. This requires an assessment of the workings of his intellect and the actions he took as a commander in response to his calculations within the appropriate military milieu. The latter is especially important because of the ingrained habit among historians, especially of the 20th century, who viewed Sherman's writing in prophetic terms and drew connections between it and later wars of a very different character, scale, and destructiveness. In short, this work reconsiders Sherman within the context of mid-19th century warfare, its ideas, society, and politics, rather than extrapolations governed by the 20th century debate over total war with which Sherman is frequently associated. This approach has been aided by the general direction of Civil War scholarship since the 1990s. Historians have shown a tendency to calculate downward the levels of destruction inflicted on the South during the Civil War. Mark E. Neely complains of the strained emphasis on destructive modernity in the writing on the Civil War. He rejects the notion that during the 4 years of the Civil War, a crescendo of violence swept away all restraint, that moral barriers as well as technological ones to the advent of truly and indiscriminate warfare had been breached decisively. And during that breach, Sherman led the storming party, having assumed the symbolic role of the harbinger of the return to barbarism. This book is intended to contribute to the revision of a return to barbarism. Its stress on the intellectual and social context and the precise calculations that Sherman made, particularly in relation to the problems involved in the maintenance of military movement, will lead to a fresh understanding of his famous marches. In short, this book aims to give the main issues of Sherman's military life a different twist, combine them in novel ways, ask different questions of the material, and reach new conclusions about Sherman's Civil War based on the issues and preoccupations of his own time. It seeks to understand levels of work and activity, or the skills that are needed at a particular rank, those needed to command a battalion or a regiment being very different from those required to command an army, which demands greater breadth of knowledge, vision, and a different kind of imagination. The choices Sherman made were not invariably influenced by the tactical progress on the battlefield, but were frequently determined by very different strategic political factors. Operational and strategic concerns often came to the fore, and Sherman's sense of his true priorities should always be made clear. The shift in contemporary Western armed forces to a more comprehensive understanding of the nature of operational art and its vital link to strategy, the overall objectives set by political leaders between means and end, has been of inestimable value in assessing the kind of decisions that were made in the past. The very best past practitioners of operational art had an instinctive understanding of its importance, even if they did not call it that. My argument has three essential dimensions. First, it will seek an explanation of his response to problems over which he had little direct control. It is important to remember that most of his military career was spent as a subordinate commander. His cerebral reactions are one way of moderating the interaction with the chain of command and his responsibilities, both upward to his seniors, eventually to the general-in-chief and president, and downward to his subordinates. Sherman had a wide range of literary and historical interests and was a natural teacher. His pre-1861 life was happiest when he served as a college president. The conduct of war is not directly an intellectual process, and nor can it ever be. The ideas found on a page of a book cannot be immediately transferred to the battlefield. War is, above all things, a clash of instincts. Ideas, however, did fertilize the solutions that Sherman arrived at. They gave his thoughts shape and a sense of proportion, and permitted him to arrive at distinct solutions before his opponents could react. Like all ideas, they have weaknesses as well as strengths. All commanders need to recognize when action is needed, and also to identify the paths required to drive subordinates forward to secure their parts in the overall plan. Sherman was a hard taskmaster, and sometimes expressed frustration with the comparative inertia of some of his subordinates. Such difficulties were largely the product of forces, systems, or structures beyond his control, particularly the lopsided organization of the armies that he commanded. It was only in the spring of 1865, just as the war ended, that that Sherman was able to fashion a structure best suited to his requirements. These unpredictable circumstances ensured that ideas cannot leap unmodified from their pages onto the field of battle. Second, Sherman's intellectual dexterity will be assessed, his ability to learn and adapt from experience. This requires, more than anything else, a discussion of how Sherman commanded. This book is structured around his eventual rise after one severe interruption through successive levels: regiment, division, corps, army, military division, and finally, commanding general. Detailed coverage is offered of Sherman's relations with his subordinates and how these relations changed over time. It examines how Sherman harnessed their talents and delegated to Francis P. Blair, Jr., James B. McPherson, George H. Thomas, John M. Schofield, Joseph Hooker, John A. Logan, Oliver O. Howard, and Henry W. Slocum, among others. How did Sherman harness their talents? How effectively did he delegate? Particular attention is given to where Sherman placed himself on campaign to ensure accessibility so that senior subordinates might be able to confer with him without too much difficulty. On crowded or chaotic battlefields, simply finding the commander is a task of no small difficulty. The book also explores what use Sherman made of his staff in commanding ever-growing formations. Third, the discussion takes account of the technical sides of war, as these present significant intellectual challenges. The most immediately pressing for Sherman concerned logistics and sustainability. Armies had to be kept moving, and they had to be supplied over great distances and frequently over inhospitable, barren, poorly mapped, or even unmapped terrain. The railroads and telegraph solved some of these problems, but by no means all, and often produced new ones. Sherman learned from hard experience that the more road transport that became available, whatever the means of coordination, the less mobile an army's constituent parts became. This book explores how Sherman solved the fundamental problem of advancing over great distances in sparsely populated and poorly developed country. These challenges were fiendishly difficult and stretched his organizational and intellectual powers, but he overcame them. Much attention is given to Sherman's intricate logistical planning and preparation for his campaigns. Logistics is the all-important link between thought and practice, for any detailed logistical plan requires intricate preparation to sustain any lengthy campaign. This requires thorough knowledge of topography, movement, and the means of supply. Sherman conscientiously labored over all of these and was assiduous in carrying out a thorough personal reconnaissance whenever required while on campaign. However, this book is still a biography, and its starting point remains Sherman's character. Even as it rejects the assumption that Sherman's strong, vibrant, and sometimes uncomfortable personality is the source of all his actions, it does not imply that personal attributes were not critical in commanders. They must be personally courageous to function usefully in the hazardous and chaotic conditions of the battlefield, avers Colonel Roger Nye, a scholar of command methods. They cannot allow fatigue to cloud their minds. They must get their troops to fight. They must wage violence competently. And, of course, they must win. Sherman displayed all these attributes, and his energy and stamina remained phenomenal into old age. Although earlier biographers have denied this, Sherman's ruminating imagination reveals a powerful intellectual cast of mind. What does the term intellectual mean in this world of soldiers and war, from which refinement and the climate of civilized values seems to have been banished? Conventional definitions stress that intellectuals live for ideas and are dedicated to the life of the mind, which is very much like a religious commitment. The military intellectual may be no less preoccupied with the life of the mind, but is a very distinct subspecies, because its members pursue ideas in a very particular habitat of violence. Military intellectuals seek out answers to the very specific problems posed by war. It is important not to confuse intellectuality with academic study. They are by no means identical, especially in war, when all ultimately lies in the execution, not the conception. Of course, Sherman came from a society, especially in the American West, inclined to underrate intellectual endeavor. During the first decade of his life, the governing class of the United States, a patrician intellectual elite, was displaced by an ambitious, grasping, and ruthless group of self-made, practical men who served the people, a professional political class who evinced a high level of anti-intellectualism and suspicion of elites. Sherman spent most of his life regretting this significant social development. He was a loquacious and assertive individual, much less prone than Ulysses S. Grant to conceal both his reading and his views. At various times in his life, Sherman felt himself to be an outsider, a servant, or a scapegoat. His early life appeared an irredeemable failure, saved only by the drama and opportunities offered by the Civil War. Yet in the spring and autumn of 1861, Sherman, for all his superb mental gifts, got things seriously wrong and became almost hysterical. It was at this point that he was judged mad. Cleverness, that is, inherent mental ability, alone, does not illuminate the path to success, even though Sherman enjoyed more privileges than most in what Abraham Lincoln called the race of life. Yet though the value of intellectual attributes might be exaggerated, it can still be important for a commander, particularly if he is faced by novel, perplexing circumstances. They allow him to think his way through them, as Sherman learned to do. Consequently, if we are to understand Sherman's military achievement, his heritage, background, and formative experiences are crucial in elucidating the quality of his mind and understanding how things took shape. What did Sherman read, and what did he make of it? These are important questions, and so is the nature and influence of Sherman's West Point education. Many doors were opened to Sherman in the 1850s, and he passed through them with high hopes that were quickly deflated, and then passed out again. He became despondent and disillusioned. Knowledge of Sherman's failures during the first four decades of his life illustrates, too, how much of this experience he naturally carried with him into the war. This is especially true of his political, social, and racial opinions, and his unguarded anti-democratic bias. There can be no doubt that Sherman entertained the commonplace Midwestern racism of his generation of whites. During Sherman's time in Louisiana in 1859-60, he had quickly acquired Southern habits in referring to African Americans. A notorious letter of January 1865 encapsulated this rebarbative tone. "I profess to be the best kind of friend to Sambo, and think on such a question, the recruitment of black soldiers, Sambo should be consulted." He remarked on his popularity with the freedmen. "They gather around me in crowds, and it is hard to tell in what sense I am most appreciated, in saving him from his master, or the new master that threatens him with a new species of slavery." Sherman's attitudes were not obsessive, but rather ambivalent. Though he left harsh descriptions on paper, he enjoyed friendly and unaffected personal relations with all blacks, wherever and whenever he met them. Toward the end of his life, he wrote an essay championing the rights of black citizens in the former Confederate States, which indicates that his views had shifted 180 degrees from those he had held a quarter century earlier. Likewise, his attitudes toward the Indian tribes were a good deal more liberal than the biting language he employed would indicate. Yet Sherman never seems to have expressed any sympathy in the 1850s for the American or Know-Nothing Party or agitators reflecting their views. Racial opinions in the mid-1850s that execrated African Americans, Hispanics, Indians, and Jews tended to come as a package that included anti-Masonry and hatred of newly arrived white immigrants, especially if they were Roman Catholic. But Sherman expressed unusual sympathy for the Roman Catholic Church for much of his life, having married a Catholic. Certainly, his earlier experiences in California after 1848 and the tumult he witnessed in San Francisco left him with a lifelong abhorrence of anarchy and social revolution. In 1861, Sherman was a reluctant warrior, and the reasons for his lukewarm attitudes need to be assessed. The other significant issue is Sherman's attitude to the South, which seems, again, ambivalent and complex, perhaps paradoxical. One of the few Northern generals who had lived and worked there, Sherman believed that his informed views should carry additional weight. His respect for and fear of Southern martial capabilities and organization, rather than rage, compelled Sherman to develop more punitive methods as the only way that the Confederacy could be subdued. In this interpretation, the motives that lay behind the famous marches might be psychological and political, seeking to humiliate the Confederacy rather than instilling terror by inflicting brutal and gratuitous destruction. The distinction is a fine one, but the destruction inflicted on the South was more controlled than it has often been represented, and much of the looting was in line with that experienced in earlier wars. The paradox lies at the very heart of Sherman's attitude to the South. He was a conservative figure, yet he sought to create havoc psychologically and break the bonds of a cohesive white society that he had, in many respects, admired. He freed more slaves than any other Union commander, but he was temperamentally disinclined to support the progressive measures that would prevent former Confederates from retaining power after 1865. In short, despite the flow of recent biographies, the subject of Sherman's military career is far from closed in terms of either scholarly or public scrutiny. My consideration of the post-1865 years will be attuned to this fresh context. Although he has been remembered most for his activities during the Civil War, this book will examine the approaches that Sherman adopted while commanding general of the U.S. Army after 1869, as his reforms were largely based on the deductions that he drew from the experience of 1861-65. Sherman sought to fight future wars by enlarging the U.S. Army's brain and capacity to expand itself in time for the next war, and avoid the confusion, muddle, and waste he had witnessed in 1861-62. He sought a compromise of an expandable army formed around a regular corps. The study of the Civil War has witnessed an unusual commingling of military thought and military history, and Sherman contributed to both. As for the latter, attention will be devoted to Sherman's methods in conveying his own historical experience and his emphatic rejection of the nostrums advanced by the Southern Lost Cause school of writers and apologists after 1880. A renewed understanding of all these links should establish a full and proper context for Sherman's mid-19th century ideas. Ideas, however, need to be reformulated for them to be translated into deeds. They need an intermediary like William T. Sherman to invigorate the soul of an army. It is now timely to consider his formative experiences. Part 1. The Formative Years, 1822-1861. 1. Origin and Evolution of the Sherman Family to 1840. Unlike many of his fellow countrymen, William T. Sherman did not display an enduring fascination with his family tree. His treatment of it in his memoirs is perfunctory. He never bothered to inspect his ancestral home, even during his European tour of 1872. Consequently, his biographers have been perplexed by his ancestry, or thought better of treating it in detail. The Sherman family hailed from southeastern England, and played a minor part in the upheavals that culminated in a great civil war that engulfed the British Isles from 1642 to 1651.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?